So thank you for having me here today, and thank you for this kind of great turnout and great environment to give this talk in. I am going to be sort of juggling slides in front of me and slides behind me, so hopefully I will get this working properly. Before I get started, one very quick caveat to this talk. I come out of the humanities, right? I work for the Modern Language Association, and so some of what I'm talking about here, some of the context for this talk comes specifically out of that world and out of the very peculiar realm of fields in which the book is still the primary form of scholarly communication. But I think there are a lot of correspondences with fields that have been less book-centric. So we'll sort of talk some about those correspondences as we go forward. But the talk itself begins with a reminder from Cass Sunstein about the pressures of the status quo. In many cases, traditions last not because they are excellent, but because influential people are averse to change and because of the sheer burdens of transition to a better state. So the talk that I'm giving today is very much future-oriented. It's focused on the changes that are taking place across scholarly communication in the academy right now. But it starts with the past, in no small part because certain aspects of the ways that scholars have traditionally worked are, I believe, rapidly becoming obsolete. Now, when I say that they're becoming obsolete, I don't mean to say that we're facing the death of the book, or the journal as a means of scholarly communication, for instance, only that certain aspects of our reliance on the book as a primary mode of scholarly communication aren't serving us as well as they once might have. Now, my own perspective on this issue comes in part from working with folks in the digital humanities, scholars who are producing work that simply can't be captured in print form or in any of its analogs. But I want to acknowledge a problem with this term, with the digital humanities, as it seems to indicate that there's some other branch of the humanities out there that's analog, right, and that therefore need not be party to the discussions that are taking place inside digital humanities. And I want to suggest that a better concept might in fact be the humanities in and for the digital age, or even better, scholarship in and for the digital age, as this begins to make clear that all fields and all subfields are really affected by the new technologies that many of us are working really intimately with. Well, in fact, my work over the last few years has been focused precisely on getting those parts of the humanities that feel themselves to be most analog to understand how it is that they are all already digital and how the digital is changing their work, whether visibly or invisibly. And of course, one of the primary arenas for that change is in scholarly communication. Now, it's probably not entirely a surprise that I would say that, both given the audience, and also given my own job title. I joined the staff of the Modern Language Association in July 2011 in order to help the association and its members think about the kinds of changes that are taking place today in scholarly communication across the profession, as scholars are moving increasingly from a sole focus on the production of books and journal articles to a much more fluid range of modes of communication. So I want to start today by giving you a little bit of the background that explains how I came to those issues before turning to talk about where it is that we're headed. So the short version of the recap. What feels like a very long time ago now, I finished a dissertation that focused on the relationship between the contemporary American novel and television. I was lucky enough to find a tenure-track job in a really awesome place, and I started the process of turning that dissertation into a book, which is the thing that one must do in English in order to get tenure. So as I'm doing that revision, I did the thing that I had been advised to do, which was to send out queries to university presses and see who might be interested in publishing this thing. There weren't quite that many queries, but it felt like it at certain moments. Anyway, I worked and I waited, and as it turns out, the three presses that I was most interested in all were interested in the book as well, and they said that I should send the full manuscript as soon as it was ready. Now, unfortunately, as soon as it was ready, took a little bit longer than I was expecting. Starting a new assistant professorship at a small liberal arts college took a good bit of my focus, and then there's the writing is hard part. turning this dissertation into a book just wasn't the straightforward process that I had kind of naively assumed it was going to be. But it finally did get done, and 3 years after those initial queries, I started writing back to the presses that had expressed interest in the dissertation, not entirely realizing that the bursting of the dot-com bubble, which had happened in the meantime, was going to have an effect here. But it did. The response from all three of the presses was pretty much the same. This is a great project, we still love it, but we can't afford to publish it right now. So I scrambled a little bit and I sent out more queries. This now begins to start looking like that pile. And I got more of the same response. Now, one press finally did ask to see the manuscript, though, and sent it out to external reviewers and got positive reviewers' reports and had an editor who was enthusiastic about the project. But after holding on to it for nearly a year, the press finally declined. The editor had been overruled on the board by the marketing guys, who said that the project posed too much financial risk to pursue in the current economy. This, sadly, was a quote from the rejection letter that I got. Now, this particular cause for rejection prompted two immediate responses among the people around me, the first of which was most clearly articulated by my mother, who said they were planning on making money off of your book. Now, the fact is they were, right? Not much, perhaps, but that the press involved needed the book to make money, right? At least enough to return its costs, and that it doubted that it would, highlights the serious economic problems that scholarly publishing continues to face today. I mean, there's no small irony in the fact that I was facing this situation, however, as the argument that I had made in this book was precisely that the book is not a dying form, and that claims that it is often serve quite conservative ends, shoring up very traditional cultural hierarchies against infiltration by mass culture. And yet, here I was, suddenly beginning to wonder whether the academic book might in fact be facing a kind of death, one that had less to do with any decline in our need for it than in our ability to support it going forward. Now, as it turned out, after about another year and a half of sending out fruitless queries, I finally did find a fabulous press to publish the book with, Vanderbilt University Press. But the whole intervening mess left me wondering whether there might be a better way. And after all, right after I finished the revisions on the manuscript, this is a full 4.5 years before the book finally sees the light of day, I'm feeling somewhat impatient about wanting to get some ideas out there into circulation. Now, I started a blog, which is coming up on its 11th anniversary this summer. And this blog helped me develop an audience, a community, well in advance of any of my more traditional publications. So while the first response to the rejection that I'd received was my mother's somewhat bewildered disbelief, the second response was instead about possibilities. As my friend Matt Kirschenbaum asked me in a comment on a blog post that I'd written about this entire debacle, why couldn't I just take the manuscript and the two positive readers' reports and publish the whole thing online, right? Voila, peer-reviewed publication. Now, he backs down from that possibility in this comment, saying that he understands why it isn't realistic. But frankly, I didn't on some level. I mean, why not start a new online publishing network, one that might actually learn from the dynamic communities that it built up around blogging? I mean, why not remake scholarly publishing into something that actually works? Now, I will admit that I have been accused of being a starry-eyed optimist with respect to this sort of thing, but honestly, I believe there is a cause for optimism here. The connections that I had found through this early community of academic bloggers really gave me hope. I mean, this was a supportive community of colleagues who were working together and working ideas through. And blogging in these early days had helped me form a little utopian intentional community. And I thought maybe some of the things that I had found in that community might be generalized outward. So working with the Institute for the Future of the Book, my co-editor Avi Santo and I founded Media Commons, which is a network in which scholars in media studies could share and discuss their work and develop new kinds of collaborations. Media Commons has been up and running for the better part of 5 years now and has developed a number of projects, including In Media Res, which asks 5 scholars a week to comment briefly on some up-to-the-minute media text as a means of opening discussion about the issues that it presents for media scholars, students, practitioners, and activists. Similarly, The New Everyday is an experiment in middle state publishing, focusing on articles that are more formal than blog posts, but not yet sealed into the fixity of the journal article. Alt Academy similarly remediates the edited volume or journal as a space for lengthier, ongoing discussion about a particular issue. And Media Commons Press is publishing longer texts for open discussion. Now, working on Media Commons has been extremely gratifying, but it's made clear to me how difficult changing a culture can be. Getting scholars, administrators, publishers, and institutions all to invest their time, effort, and resources in new ways of working requires, in many cases, changing the ways that they think. Getting past that, I can't do X because of Y. Changing the things that scholars and institutions prioritize, changing the ways that they assign value to the products of academic labor. And this kind of change is never easy, particularly given the fundamentally conservative nature of academic institutions and of the academics that comprise them. I mean, in the main, we are extraordinarily resistant to changes in our ways of working. I mean, it's not without reason that a senior colleague of mine once joked to me that the motto of our institution, and one that I think may be recognizable to many of you, could well be, "We have never done it that way before." Or as Donald Hall has put it, scholars often resist applying the critical skills that we bring to our subject matter to an examination of what he calls the textuality of our own profession, its scripts, values, biases, and behavioral norms. And it's not entirely surprising. I mean, this kind of self-criticism is a risky endeavor. And those of us who have been privileged enough to succeed within the existing system often don't have quite the impetus that is necessary to bite the hand that's quite literally feeding us. Changing our technologies, changing our ways of doing research, changing our modes of production and distribution of the results of that research, all of these things are necessary, I believe, to the continued vitality of the academy. And yet none of those changes can possibly come about unless there's first a profound change in the ways of thinking of scholars themselves. And until scholars genuinely believe that publishing on the web is just as valuable as publishing in print or in a print analog format, and even more importantly, until they believe that their institutions believe it too, few of them will be willing to risk their careers on a new way of working, with the result that that new way of working will remain marginal, undervalued, and risky. So what I'm interested in then is not just the technological changes that many believe are necessary to allow academic publishing to flourish into the future, but the social, institutional, and intellectual changes that are necessary to pave the way for those technologies. In order for new modes of communication to become broadly accepted within the academy, scholars and their institutions have got to take a new look at the mission of the university, the goals of scholarly publishing, and the processes through which scholars conduct their work. We need to collectively consider what it is that new technologies have to offer us, not just in terms of how they can help us reduce the cost of publishing or how they can help us increase access to publications, though these are, of course, enormous issues that demand more exploration, but rather how these new technologies will help change the ways that we do research, how they'll change the ways that we write, and how they'll change the ways that we review. And it's the structures of peer review that I argue that we need to begin with, not least because over the course of developing Media Commons, in the dozens of meetings and conferences and panel discussions that we participated in, every single conversation came back again and again to the question, what are you going to do about peer review? And no wonder, I suppose. I mean, concerns about peer review are perfectly understandable, given that it is, in some sense, the sine qua non of the Academy. I mean, we employ it in almost every aspect of the ways that we work, from hiring decisions through promotion and tenure reviews, in internal and external grant fellowship competitions, and, of course, in publishing. And the work that we do as scholars is repeatedly subjected to a series of vetting processes that enable us to indicate that the results of our work have been scrutinized by the authorities in the field and that those results are therefore themselves authoritative. But I also want to suggest that the current system of peer review is in fact part of what's broken. There's a rather extraordinary literature available, mostly in the sciences and social sciences, on the problems with conventional peer review, including its biases and its flaws. And every scholar, I would be willing to bet, has had some moment of direct personal experience of those biases and flaws. The review that misses the point, the review that seems like it's somehow got to be personally motivated, or perhaps worst, the review that we never even actually get to see. And for such an imperfect system, peer review as we know it requires an astonishing amount of labor on our part, and it's a kind of labor for which we can never really receive credit. So when Matt Kirschenbaum says that what ought to count is peer review and scholarly merit, not the physical form in which the text is ultimately delivered, I absolutely agree. But at the same time, I feel quite strongly that the system of peer review today that we are using could be vastly improved, particularly in a networked environment. And for that reason, I want to force us to take a closer look at what it is that we mean when we say peer review, what it is that we expect peer review to accomplish for us, and how these kinds of processes might best work online. Now, one of the problems with using our current model of peer review in digital publishing is what I see as a fundamental misalignment between the net native means through which authority is determined online and what Mario Biagioli has referred to as the disciplinary technology of peer review, which is a decidedly Foucauldian mode of self-policing that regulates knowledge through discipline. Now, the problems with transferring this disciplinary technology to the networked world is in no small part that the network has its own technologies. The placement of conventional peer review prior to selection for publication in a traditional print-based process indicates that it serves a primarily gatekeeping function, one that allows certain kinds of academic discourse to thrive while excluding other sorts of ideas from the realm of the thinkable. Now, this kind of gatekeeping is arguably necessary in print in order to cope with the scarcities of print's economics. Only so many pages in so many books and journals can be published each year. In the digital, however, this kind of scarcity is over. Right? Because anyone can publish anything online, and at least from a perspective that values the free and open communication of the products of scholarly research, not only can but should, we face instead an extraordinary plenitude. And thus, I argue that what digital scholarly publishing must focus on is not developing a means of applying the current system of peer review to new modes of online work in order to create a kind of artificial scarcity, but instead focus on developing a means of coping with abundance. As it is, increasing numbers of scholars are either self-publishing their work via their blogs, or they're forming new online publishing networks like Media Commons. And in many cases, these kinds of open publications are having a far greater impact on the scholarly community, than their traditional peer-reviewed publications are. I mean, it's certainly true in my case. All of my first things like citations and lecture invitations and other forms of traditional public recognition for my work stemmed not from my journal articles or from my book, but instead from the work that I was doing on my blog. But of course, these new modes of online publishing demand some kind of assessment, even if that assessment comes after the fact. For that reason, peer review online needs to include some kind of open post-publication means of review that doesn't determine whether a text should be published, but rather measures how it has been and how it should be received, what its place in the ecosystem of scholarly communication is, and what kinds of responses it's provoked. Now, such a system would shift the center of gravity from regulation to communication, transforming peer review itself into a mechanism for facilitating more fluid and productive exchanges amongst peers, and not at all incidentally, into a system in which the work of reviewing itself becomes visible as work, and the reviews themselves become part of the scholarly record. So what I argue that we need to produce then is a system of peer-to-peer review, one that takes advantage of networked publishing's capacity for discussion and dialogue, as well as of what Michael Jensen has called the new metrics of scholarly authority. Things like hits and downloads, of course, but also those more qualitative measures like comments and inbound links, which reveal how web-based texts get used, in order to provide a post-publication means of filtering the wealth of content that should be made available via networked publishing. After all, scarcity does linger in internet-based communication. It's just that for the most part, what has become scarce is time and attention, rather than the materials of production. So what internet-based scholarly communication requires is not gatekeepers, but filters. Systems that allow a community of scholars who are working with and responding to one another to set and maintain their own standards, guiding one another to the best work that's being produced in their fields. Now, in order to put my money, at least metaphoric money, where my mouth was, I put the entire draft of my recent book, Planned Obsolescence, online for open review. It wasn't a perfect process by any means. There are things that I would do differently if I were going to do it again, but it was nonetheless exciting. I was able to discuss the text at a far earlier stage than I would have been able otherwise. And I had reviewers who were discussing the text with one another, disagreeing at times on points of assessment. And I also know a lot of things about the text. For instance, I know that in the first 9 months after the project launched, it had over 31,000 page loads. Over 12,000 unique visitors came by for the first time, and 3,300 of them came back repeatedly. 44 unique commenters left a total of 295 comments, and during this same 9-month period, the project was written about and linked to in more than 20 venues, including a review article in a scholarly journal, right? The book wasn't even out yet, and there was already a review of it. And it was in that same period also taught in at least 4 graduate seminars and 1 undergraduate seminar that I know of. And I want to place that alongside the fact that the average scholarly press monograph in the humanities sells fewer than 400 copies over its lifetime. Now, numbers aren't everything, right? But they are significant, and particularly when coupled with the ability to see the reception of a text in action. Of course, an online review process like this produces some complications for our notion of publication and what it is. And what purposes it serves. I mean, was my text actually published in 2009? When NYU released the print version in 2011, was that in effect a second edition? What's the status of this online version now that the print version is out? And what's the relationship between the reader's comments on the online version and the ways that I've incorporated them in the revision of the print version? A broadly implemented peer-to-peer review system will, I believe, require us to think in new ways about authorship, in no small part because these new modes of review will almost certainly necessitate a turn from thinking about academic publishing as being focused on the production and dissemination of individual products, to instead imagining a system that's focused much more broadly on facilitating the processes of scholarly work, as the time and effort required to maintain a gift economy-driven system of peer-to-peer review will really require that scholars place some portion of their primary emphasis not on their own individual achievements, but rather on the advancement of the community as a whole. Now, I will acknowledge that this kind of collectivity is a utopian ideal, and to some significant degree, it goes against our training as scholars, and particularly as scholars in the humanities. What we accomplish alone, witness the persistence of the single author publication. And in fact, I gave a talk at a humanities-oriented conference not terribly long ago, focusing on this post-publication peer-to-peer review business, and sort of focused on the degree to which it inculcates a kind of helpfulness as its primary value. And when I went through the Twitter stream after the talk, a colleague of mine had commented, "Helpfulness is not part of our graduate training." Okay. We genuinely believe, in many ways, that what we accomplish alone, or at least so it seems to us. Right? Roland Barthes, of course, claimed back in 1967 that no text is a single line of words, but that each is instead a fabric of quotations. I mean, we have long acknowledged the death of the author, in theory at least, but we haven't given much time to thinking about what a proclamation like this might mean for our own status as authors. And I want to acknowledge that I'm not asking anybody to part with the lines on the CV that are the result of our authorship. But I do want to suggest that digital networks, as structures that facilitate interaction, communication, and interconnection, are going to require us to think differently about what it is that we're doing as we write. I mean, as the example of the blog might suggest, communities best engage with one another around work that's open rather than closed, work that's in process and ongoing rather than concluded. New publishing systems that foreground process will likely encourage us to publish work earlier in its development, in the humanities that might be at the conference paper stage, for instance, and to remain engaged with those texts much longer after they've been released to readers than we're accustomed. Now, admittedly, this makes a lot of people nervous. It makes me a little nervous about letting the messiness of our processes be seen, about the prospect of never being fully done with a project. But it's worth considering why it is that we're doing the work in the first place. I mean, to the degree that scholarship is about participating in an exchange of ideas with one's peers, new networked publishing structures can facilitate that kind of interaction. But they'll do so best if the discussion is allowed to remain open. Now, this foregrounding of process, however, may also likely require authors to be prepared to relinquish a certain degree of control over their work, letting go of the illusion that that work springs wholly from the individual intelligence, and acknowledging the ways that scholarship, even in those fields in the humanities in which sole authorship remains the norm, has always nonetheless been collaborative. The conversational structures of the web will inevitably intensify these collaborative relationships, sometimes producing new co-authoring situations, though not always. It's clear, however, that we'll need to develop new citational practices that fully acknowledge the participation of our peers in the development of our work. And along the way, I believe that we're also going to need to think differently about originality in scholarly production. I'm recognizing that in a networked environment in which more and more discourse is available, some of the most important work that we do as scholars may more closely resemble contemporary editorial practices, sort of bringing together and highlighting and even remixing significant ideas in existing texts. And we need to find ways for these new modes of authorship, modes that are process-centered, that are collaborative, that are remix-oriented, to count within our current systems of evaluation. Now, there are lots of other such changes that I believe are going to be required throughout the entire academic community if new publishing practices like these are to take root. Publishers, for instance, are going to need to think differently about their business models, which may need to focus more on the provision of services and less on the sale of objects. They'll need to think differently about their editorial practices, which are likely to require a greater investment in guiding the development of projects from an early stage. And they're definitely going to need to think differently about the structures of texts, which may become less linear and will undoubtedly become less uniformly textual. They'll also need to think in concert with libraries about archival and preservation practices, ensuring that the kinds of texts that we're producing today remain available and accessible tomorrow. And universities, in the broadest sense, will need to rethink the relationship between the library, the university press, the information technology center, and the academic units within the institution, reimagining the funding model under which publishing operates, and remembering the institutional purposes that such publishing was invented to serve. But also, and really crucially, reimagining the relationship between the academic institution and the surrounding culture. As new systems of networked knowledge production become increasingly prevalent and influential online, the university and the scholars who comprise it need to find ways to adapt these systems to our needs, or we will run the risk of becoming increasingly irrelevant to the ways that contemporary culture produces and communicates authority. Now, all of this is explained in much greater length in my book, Planned Obsolescence, which came out from NYU Press late in 2011. And yes, I do see the irony in putting this argument out in book form. But again, it's that analog humanities that I really felt like I most needed to reach with this argument. But just as I was finishing up this book, I got asked to see whether some of the ideas that I'd been reading about, writing about might actually be tested on a large scale. The Office of Scholarly Communication was established by the Executive Council of the Modern Language Association and was charged with bringing together and reimagining the existing book publishing program and the web editorial functions of the association. The new structure is meant to grapple with the growing understanding that scholarly communication, in the sense that's somewhat broader than publishing per se, is the very foundation of what scholarly societies do, right? It's the purpose since the Royal Society of London for which they have been founded. Given that, the new office touches every part of the organization, from its continuing publishing activities to member relations to policy to the convention. The office has two primary responsibilities, however, to think about the future of our book publications as our means of engaging with book-based content become increasingly digital, and to think about the born digital platforms for new kinds of communication in which our members are going to want to engage and will need us to support in order to facilitate their developing scholarly practices. So the relatively easy part of this first area involves thinking about how our print projects will best circulate as ebooks, right? As well as taking projects that to this point have only existed in print and thinking about how the digital might enable new and better kinds of interaction with them. For example, we recently conducted the New Variorum Shakespeare Digital Challenge, releasing the XML from our most recent Variorum volume under a Creative Commons license and encouraging scholars to produce the most exciting interface or API or visualization using it, which helped us to see more about what the future possibilities for the Variorum might be. Now, there's, of course, a lot that remains to be figured out on this end of our charge. Huge questions about sustainable business practices and open access loom large ahead of us, but at least we know what those questions are at this point. The other half of our charge is a good bit more complicated and a good bit more fuzzy. I mean, not only are these born digital platforms themselves always in development, sort of sliding out from under you as you work toward them, but their adoption requires a new perspective on the role of the scholarly society in the digital age. And it's possible, for instance, that the locus of the value of the scholarly society is shifting from providing its members with closed access to the products of the society to instead facilitating the broadly open distribution of the work that's being done by its members. Now, this is a massive change, right? From a situation in which you join a society in order to receive its journal, to one in which you join in order to get your work out into a common conversation among the members of that society. So we've chosen to begin thinking about these born digital platforms and how they might create new relationships with and among our members by building MLA Commons, which is a platform that was launched in early January at our convention. MLA Commons is designed to support a wide range of forms of member-to-member communication, collaboration, feedback, and publishing. And we're extremely grateful to have received a grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to support its development. We're also benefiting quite extraordinarily from the generosity of the CUNY Academic Commons team, who are in turn supported by the Sloan Foundation in generalizing the model that they've built here for our use. The CUNY Academic Commons has developed a really robust platform for complex scholarly communication, linking faculty and graduate students at all of the many CUNY campuses around New York. They've now developed that platform into what they've called Commons in a Box, for which the MLA is one of the first major partners. Now, the Commons software is entirely open source. Its base platform is the popular blog engine WordPress, running with the social network plugin BuddyPress and a host of other associated plugins. And the Commons team has its eye on what its projects can give back to those developer communities. We at the MLA, in turn, have the goal of generalizing the model that we've built, opening our platform to other organizations and associations. Now, any member of the MLA can activate their account on the Commons, and with that account, they can create a profile. And that profile will allow them to join discussion groups, to publish an individual blog or work on a group blog, to share post and share documents, to work collaboratively on projects, and a number of other things besides. Groups on the Commons can be open or closed membership, and they can do their work openly or in private. And in this way, Commons groups can support the work of MLA committees and other bodies that have ongoing projects. It can also support the work of the existing divisions and discussion groups within the organization, but it can also support the work of ad hoc groups of scholars who come together around particular projects. And this, I believe, will really help us begin developing a more fluid structure for the organization itself, right, as groups will be able to sort of form and reform and fade away as needed. The blogs that are part of this network are open outlets on which individual members or groups of members are able to share their work and to communicate with a range of broader publics. And the site also provides several other ways for members to connect with one another, to publish their work, to collaborate on new projects, and to discuss the issues that matter to them. So we're hoping that there will be lots of unfiltered, open content that gets produced within this network. But we're also thinking about the future of the Commons as a formal publication platform as well. And so we're developing a set of workflows that will enable groups to implement whatever kinds of editorial filtering they wish to engage in, highlighting and aggregating the best stuff that's going on in their subfields across the Commons. And in this line, we've released what we're thinking of as an evolving anthology, Literary Studies in the Digital Age, which, unlike an edited print volume, will be able to grow and change over time. Now, we also hope that our divisions and discussion groups will begin to serve an editorial function within the Commons. That, for instance, the Division on 19th Century American Literature's Executive Committee might develop its own aggregation and filtering system through which it could gather and link to its sense of the best recent writing in the network on that subfield. Now, this could result in the development of what we think of as a kind of post-publication peer review for the openly published content within the network, giving its authors the sort of recognition that the work requires. Now, the site is still in beta at this point, so we're actively seeking input from our membership on the directions for its future development. And we have on our agenda a range of projects that will enable the Commons to connect with other major MLA resources, including the convention. But we've spent a lot of time thinking about what I think is going to be the most important question we face, which is how to create buy-in amongst the membership for using the platform. Other scholarly societies have attempted to roll out platforms for member communication, only to discover that if you build it, they will not necessarily come. Users face a kind of profile fatigue, and those who are most likely, in fact, to be early adopters of online modes of communication, frankly, already feel that their needs have been met through the existing channels that they have at their disposal. So we're trying to imagine this launch as part of an extended testing process, right? Gathering information about what it is that our members do and don't need in this platform, as well as a means of encouraging early adopters to actually help us by creating some exciting content, by demonstrating what the platform can and can't do, and by pushing at its edges. We're talking a great deal about how we can get members to come build the kind of community that I found in my early blogging days, and how they might take this platform and genuinely make it their own. I mean, my sense is that a network such as this one will come of age when its users do things with it that we could never have predicted at the outset. The question is how best to enable them to imagine those new possibilities. So for instance, what kinds of new possibilities for peer review might emerge from the communities of practice that self-organize on a platform like MLA Commons? I mean, how might a network like ours benefit from the kinds of work that are being done at the Center for History and New Media on Press Forward, which is a partly algorithmic, partly editorial mode of aggregating and filtering and republishing work that's been published across the open web? And what other kinds of technologies and practices will we want to put in place to allow members to experiment with new modes of review? Now, this past year, Media Commons and NYU Press conducted a study and released a white paper on open review practices. And we got a lot of feedback during the open review of the open review white paper, both about ways to strengthen our recommendation and about ways that open review might develop going forward. And so the good news is the MLA has some opportunities from which we can learn. We're also actively thinking about how our platform will be able to connect to and work with other in-development projects in scholarly communication, such as Scalar, which is a project that facilitates the development of robust, multilinear, multimodal projects. As our partnership with CUNY might suggest, we have no intention of reinventing the wheel, but we rather want to help existing projects like these develop and gain purchase within our fields. And we're, of course, thinking about how a network like this one might be a way that scholarly societies can help further the goal of open access, further realizing the value that they provide to their members by helping them get their work out to the world, where it can have the greatest possible public benefit and produce the greatest possible interest in the research being done in the humanities. We hope to find ways over the coming months to work with our fellow scholarly societies to expand this network in truly interdisciplinary ways. So that's a few of the things that we've been up to in scholarly communication at the MLA. But what does all of this mean for scholarship in and for the digital age? Most importantly, I think it means that we're recognizing that the root of everything we do as scholars has always been less about producing certain kinds of objects than it has been about a broader sense of the processes of communication, of exchanging ideas with our colleagues in ways that facilitate the development of new knowledge across our fields. Even more, even when they've been produced and consumed in relative isolation, these forms of communication have always been fundamentally social, connecting scholars in a wide variety of relationships. As our means of communication become increasingly technologized, I think we have a tendency to assume that we face a set of problems that have technological solutions. I would argue, however, that the challenges that are facing the humanities in particular today, but scholarship more broadly, have always had overwhelmingly social solutions. It's my hope that working together, researchers, librarians, technologists, publishers, societies, and administrators can collectively build something that none of us can do alone, which is a dynamic, engaging, sustainable sense of scholarship that is genuinely of and for the digital age. Thank you again for having me here.
So we have time for about one or two questions, if you'll take questions.
Sure, of course.
Christine Borgman, thank you, Kathleen.
Hi, Christine, how are you?
Great. I've been in Oxford this last year.
Excellent.
And I am struck, I mean, as you and I have talked, the humanities have both the most to gain from these new approaches and the most to lose by not adopting them. And the open access rules that are changing the Britain, mm-hmm. The humanities are the most defensive, the most heels dug in of any community of all of them. What arguments are you finding that resonate most? You know, how are you reaching the hearts and minds to convince people? You know, what gets to them?
That is a very, very interesting question. there is an extent to which I'm making the same argument, but with two extremely different valences. Two scholars who are already invested on some level in the digital, who have found community on Twitter, who understand the influence that blogs can have, who are thinking about the ways that they're already networking with one another. Being able to suggest to them that taking the work that they're doing in these more closed formats and moving it into open spaces enables them to see that there are greater kinds of connections and conversations that can build across that work. And they've seen it happen. They've seen evidence of the ways that getting your work out into that open circulation, in fact, produces a greater engagement and a greater benefit for the work and for the scholar. On the other hand, a large percentage of the membership of my association that is not in that place, right? That is not blogging, that is not on Twitter, that is just now really encountering a network like this one for the first time. What we're attempting to do is to suggest that this kind of network can allow you to keep doing the work that you're doing, but in a more connected, more fluid, more open fashion, right? So it's not a threat to our existing ways of working. What it is instead is a supplement, a benefit. I like to think of MLA Commons as sort of a gateway drug for the digital humanities, right? Once you come in and see that I can put a paper here and so many more people will read it than will read it actually in the journal in which it eventually appears. And they will also be able to read it so much sooner that I can get direct response and I can get that response more quickly. It begins to get scholars to think, wait, there might be another way. Another benefit of the network like this that I think is equally non-threatening to existing ways of working is understanding how a network can provide access to the kinds of conversations that one has at the convention every year, but on an ongoing basis, right? The convention doesn't have to happen in those 4 days and then be over. And I think there has been a sort of hunger for that ongoing conversation, even amongst scholars who really are perfectly content and see no problem with the ways that they're working. So I'm hoping to make very subtle inroads and persuade more and more humanists to kind of join us on the other side.
Kathleen, what a wonderful start to this meeting your talk has given us. I wanted to ask you what relationship you see between what you've described and the other great revolution in academia, which are massively open online courses.
Mm-hmm. That is a very, very interesting question. A good friend of mine, Jason Mattel, recently had a column that came out in the Chronicle of Higher Education in the U.S., basically suggesting that it was very interesting that of the universities that have jumped on the MOOC bandwagon, very, very few have open access policies for their scholars' research, right? And so there's this sense in which the university seems to be wanting to take our teaching and turn it loose, but not turn loose our research. And that is a misguided approach to thinking about, I believe, the benefit that scholarly work can provide to the world. My hope is that we can think about what it is that we're doing as openly as possible, that perhaps there is something in opening some of our teaching to the world that is that will be a benefit to those outside the university community. I am all in favor of creating greater connections between the university and the surrounding culture. But I have grave concerns about the organizations that we're turning this teaching material over to, about what the financial end game of the MOOC is, about who ultimately stands to benefit from the provision of all of this intellectual property in this particular manner. So I find it a little bit of concern that so many institutions have jumped with both feet on something that looks like the next thing, but also could be a bubble that will burst anytime.
I think there was one in the back.
David Prosser from Research Libraries UK. Thank you very much. That was great. I've got a quick comment and a question. The quick comment is on the UK, and it seems very strange that the UK humanists really genuinely have come to these open access discussions as if it is new. And for those of us who have been in the discussions for the past 5, 10, 15 years, that's inconceivable. But I think they're really just engaging now. So a lot of the pushback that we're seeing is exactly because it's new to them. And so they haven't gone through all the issues. My question related to the really positive numbers you had for feedback on the draft of your book. And that contrasted very much with what we see in a lot of the sciences, where open comments, commenting has been opened up on papers, and colleagues from PLOS who have pioneered this will be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the view that there have not been many comments on most papers. Do you think this tells us something fundamental about disciplinary differences, or do you think it's a transition issue that we haven't quite got to the stage where people are comfortable commenting yet?
I don't know that it's necessarily a disciplinary issue, and I would hesitate to speculate on that. I do know that community doesn't build itself, right? And particularly around new publishing platforms like this. It takes active work to get people to come in, to start conversations, to keep conversations going. There has to be motivation behind it, or scholars won't do it. And so in a world in which, you know, we've all simply been able to sort of post PDFs online, and let them circulate, and you know, and have them do their work by themselves, seemingly without scholarly intervention. Getting people to actually come and discuss and participate is not going to happen by itself. So I think it's more a transitional problem than it is a disciplinary one. I think we really do have to put much more emphasis on actually building that kind of interaction as a value, but also specifically as something that we value, something that we take as seriously as the original work that gets published. And the only way that that's going to happen, I believe, is for us actually to get credit for it, for it to be something that goes into the annual report that indicates that not only have I published these three papers this year, but I have also participated in this many external reviews, and here is the results of those reviews, and that then becomes part of the work that one does as a scholar that one gets credit for.
So there's lots of hands going up, but let's thank Kathleen again. Really great keynote.
Thank you.